for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Chance of rain and thunderstorms tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the mid-40s to low 50s. Tomorrow, 30% chance of rain and thunderstorms with highs in the 50s.
What has actually happened is very hard to determine because there's a lot of misunderstanding about aircraft, about navigation systems, about what they rely on.
The chief of the European Union was in flight when her plane's GPS suddenly went dark. Is Russia to blame?
It's Tuesday, September 2nd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, the story behind a major business breakup, Heinz going one way, Kraft another.
The complexity of our business has impacted that ability to realize the full strength of our brands and operations.
Also, we'll dig into D.C. court records to see who the feds have been arresting since they took over policing in the city.
And Jane Kennedy on the ups and downs of her barrier-breaking journey to anchoring national sports coverage.
I knew immediately they were not looking for someone like me because there were 16 women, 15 were blonde.
Those stories coming up after the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. President Trump says he is ready to deploy National Guard troops to the city of Chicago after a weekend where 8 people died and 58 were wounded in gun violence.
Chicago is a hellhole right now. Baltimore is a hellhole right now.
Trump says Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker should ask him to send in troops. Pritzker told reporters he is not asking, but they're obviously ready to go.
So in the absence of significant federal coordination, we've gathered information from unauthorized patriotic officials inside the government and from well-sourced reporters about Donald Trump's plan, which is to deploy armed military personnel to the streets of Chicago.
National Guard troops have been on the ground in Washington, D.C. Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa will not run for a third term next year. Iowa Public Radio's Katarina Sestaric has details.
Ernst says serving as a U.S. senator has been the privilege of a lifetime, and it wasn't an easy decision to not run for re-election.
Having been raised in a family who has given me so much love and support, now, as our family ages and grows, it's my time for me to give back to them.
Ernst didn't say what she'll do after her term is over. She was the first female combat veteran elected to the U.S. Senate and the first woman to represent Iowa in Congress. 2 Iowa Republicans had previously announced they'd run for Senate, and at least one more is expected to get into the race. 5 Democrats are running for the open seat. For NPR News, I'm Katarina Sestaric in Des Moines.
The U.S. government continues to collect tens of billions of dollars in tariff revenue each month, but as NPR's Scott Horsley reports, some of that money may have to be refunded.
A federal appeals court recently ruled that most of the import taxes imposed by President Trump this year are illegal, but the court left those tariffs in place for the time being while awaiting a final decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. That leaves many businesses that rely on imports in a kind of tariff limbo. Barton O'Brien will soon be placing an order for specialty dog products without knowing whether he'll have to pay a tariff when the goods are delivered next spring.
We have no idea what the price is going to be. That's a really tough negotiation to have with customers who are trying to plan things out.
The appeals court says Trump overstepped his authority when he ordered tariffs ranging from 10 to 50% on nearly everything the U.S. imports. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
A federal district court judge has ruled that Google will not have to sell its Chrome web browser. The decision sent shares of Google parent Alphabet up late this afternoon. In a complex decision, Judge Amit Mehta ordered Google to revamp its search engine, stopping short of taking the browser out of its hands. On Wall Street, the Dow lost 249 points, closing at 45,295. The Nasdaq off 175. The S&P 500 lost 44. This is NPR News. The Pentagon is poised to send as many as 600 military lawyers to the Justice Department to help process a backlog of immigration cases. With heightened prosecution of illegal immigration, there's an estimated backlog of 3.5 million cases. One of the foremost fashion magazines in the world has announced a change in leadership As NPR's Netta Ulubi reports, the longtime editor-in-chief of Vogue magazine has announced her successor.
Rumors about Anna Wintour stepping down have been swirling for weeks. You can hear the new editor-in-chief of American Vogue in her previous role hosting Vogue magazine's podcast.
This is the run-through. I'm Chloe Mal.
Mal also edited Vogue's website. 39 years old, she has worked at Vogue for 14 years. Mal is the daughter of Hollywood star Candice Bergen and French film director Louis Malle. Her new role might best be described as transitional. Anna Wintour is still her boss. Wintour remains as chief content officer at Condé Nast, that publishes Vogue. She's made it publicly known she is not yet moving out of her office. Mal has said she plans to keep Vogue relevant in a fading market, in part by publishing the magazine less frequently. Netta Ulubi, NPR News.
American maritime forces have recently boosted their presence in waters off the coast of Venezuela. Today, President Trump announced the U.S. had carried out a strike in the Southern Caribbean against a drug-carrying vessel that departed from Venezuela. On the X platform, Secretary of State Marco Rubio described the U.S. action as a lethal strike. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
6 minutes after 5 o'clock, thanks for listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. Chance of rain and thunderstorms tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the mid-40s to low-50s, northwest winds 10 to 20. More news is next on KAXC.
All Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Just over 3 weeks ago, President Trump federalized the police department and deployed the National Guard here in Washington. The administration says it's crushing crime and cleaning up the city. NPR's Ryan Lucas has been digging through court records to find out who's being arrested and what they're being charged with. Hey, Ryan.
Hi there.
Let's jump right in. What exactly have you been looking at?
So because the administration hasn't provided names or case numbers for the people who have been arrested since the federal takeover here in D.C., it's something that I wanted to try to find out. Now, D.C. is unique in that the U.S. Attorney's Office here prosecutes both local and federal cases. The vast majority end up in Superior Court, which is basically the local courthouse for local crimes. A small sliver end up in federal court. So I talked to lawyers, looked at court and arrest records and other things for cases filed in federal court and Superior Court over the first 2 weeks of Trump's federalization of the D.C. police. So from August 11th to August 25th to see what we could learn. And just to be clear, I didn't look at any of the immigration arrests that have happened. That's a separate bucket.
Okay, so if not immigration, then what did you find? What are people being charged with?
So let's start with Superior Court because the vast majority of people who are arrested go there. Attorneys in that courthouse say that they are swamped. The room where defendants are arraigned has on some days been working until at 1 in the morning, I'm told, wow. Which lawyers say is basically unheard of. Now, around 1,050 people were arrested and had their cases go through Superior Court over those first 2 weeks. A little under 20% of those cases were charged as felonies, so as more serious offenses. The rest, around 80%, were a mix of misdemeanors, warrants, things like traffic offenses, or prosecutors decided to drop the case. Lawyers say the overall number of arrests is up, but the percentage of felonies is roughly in line with the norm.
You said the U.S. Attorney's Office drops some cases. How many have they dropped?
So this is really interesting. Lawyers say the percentage of cases that the U.S. Attorney's Office drops at this early stage varies, but it's usually in the 10 to 20% range. And the office doesn't pursue the case for a host of reasons. It could be the evidence is weak, or it could be that there's a problem with the paperwork. Now, I obtained what's known as a no-paper list for every day of those first 2 weeks. It has a bunch of information, including whether the U.S. Attorney's Office is dropping the prosecution. In the first week of the federal takeover, the U.S. Attorney's Office dropped 17% of the cases. In the second week, that figure dropped to less than 1%. And that change is really striking because it's not like the issues that previously led the U.S. Attorney's Office to drop some cases have suddenly stopped happening.
And then what about the cases that have gone to federal court?
Right. There were 35 cases that have been unsealed in federal court in the first 2 weeks of the takeover. Of those, more than half involved gun charges or a mix of gun and drug charges. The other charge that has shown up a lot is assaulting, resisting, or impeding certain officers. 12 people faced that charge. Some of those involve violence. In one instance, for example, court papers say the defendant struck a federal agent with his car while fleeing an attempted arrest. But several of these are not that. In one notable case, a guy threw a sub sandwich at a federal agent. Mm-hmm. In another, a guy on a scooter allegedly spit on two National Guard troops while scooting by them.
So big picture, what do these cases tell us about Trump's takeover of the D.C. police and his arguments about crime here?
So the number of arrests is up. That's clear. But again, less than 20% of those are felonies. The most striking thing, though, is how judges and D.C. grand juries have pushed back on some of this. A federal judge dismissed one of the gun cases because the defendant had been subject to what the judge called, quote, the most illegal search, unquote, that he has ever seen. And we've also seen grand juries in D.C. refuse to indict in some cases, which is very rare. One of those instances was the case against the man who threw the sub sandwich at an immigration officer. So that suggests that, at least in some instance, some of these cases are being seen as overreach on the part of the Trump administration.
NPR's Ryan Lucas, thank you.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, the European Union's top leader had a scare. EU chief Ursula von der Leyen was in the air headed for Bulgaria when suddenly, just before landing, the plane's GPS system went dark. They were forced to circle for an hour. Eventually, the pilot had to land the plane manually using paper maps without the aid of its navigation systems. EU officials say the incident was deliberate, an intentional GPS jamming, and the culprit, they allege, is Russia. Keir Giles is a Russia expert with the international think tank Chatham House. He's here to help us try to make sense of this. Keir Giles, welcome.
Hello, Mary Louise.
Hi. So I'll note off the bat, the Kremlin says, wasn't us. The reporting of this incident, which was first came out in the Financial Times, they are calling, quote, incorrect. What do you make of it? How can we be sure one way or the other what happened to von der Leyen's plane?
Well, bizarrely, this is one of those circumstances where the Kremlin might actually be right. Of course, they're going to deny having anything to do with it. But with the reporting being incorrect, that seems a fairly reliable conclusion. What has actually happened is very hard to determine mm-hmm. because there's a lot of misunderstanding about aircraft, about navigation systems, about what they rely on. And this whole business about supposedly relying on paper maps is not as much of a drama as it's been made out to be. Until we do get a technical report for exactly what kind of interference this was, whether it targeted this specific aircraft or the area in general, or if it was just a byproduct of Russia's ongoing electronic warfare against the region, we really don't know exactly what had happened.
To fill in a little bit of the backdrop here, there is evidence, you just noted, that Russia has a well-established reputation for electronic interference, electronic warfare. Say more.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is one of the things that is often perplexing to people who've been watching this story for a long time. When this affects a public figure like von der Leyen, or in previous iterations, NATO senior officials, or the British defense minister early last year, it's treated as a new incident. But this
but those
is in
are
fact
all the things that actually happened, the British defense minister, for example?
Absolutely, yes. Okay. Grant Shapps, defense minister at the time, flying across the Baltic, a lot of excited media reporting saying that his aircraft had been targeted in a similar manner. But what that distracts from is the fact that this is the norm in a lot of regions close to Russia. Right across the Baltic Sea region, these position, navigation, and timing services that aircraft had previously took for granted and depended on are simply unavailable because of Russia's electronic warfare. So aircraft have been forced to fall back on other measures for ensuring that they know their position, they know how to navigate, how to land. Pilots who fly in the region say this is an inconvenience, but something which is so regular and expected that they are no longer treating it as something that is at all unusual.
So understanding, again, the Kremlin is denying this. Is Russia capable of doing something like this if they want to, if they want to jam the GPS of a plane trying to land?
Well, here too, knowing exactly what did happen, as opposed to what's been reported in most of the media, is key to understanding the capability and exactly how Russia might have done it. Mm-hmm. If it is a blanket interdiction of satellite services, of position navigation and timing services that make GPS work in the region, then we know perfectly well that Russia is capable of doing it because it's been doing it for years. If, on the other hand, it's something which specifically targeted this aircraft that von der Leyen was flying on, then that's a slightly more sophisticated capability, which argues that something very different is going on and it was a deliberate attempt specifically to inconvenience von der Leyen. But until we know which, we simply have no way of knowing just how serious an effort this was by Russia to prove a point.
Yeah. I mean, we've called you because you're a Russia expert, not an aviation technology expert. But if there are ongoing multiple reports of incidents like this, if I'm a senior European official flying a plane anywhere around Russian airspace, should I be taking precautions? Is there anything that can be done to prevent it?
Well, yes, you called me because I'm a Russia expert. It's just completely by coincidence that I also used to fly aeroplanes and used to fly them in Russia and have a bit of a clue.
We have identified the perfect guest. Do share that side of your expertise.
Sadly, one thing that's missing from a lot of this reporting is actually talking to the pilots that fly these routes who would be able to tell you that this is perfectly normal. It would be astonishing if precautions were not being taken by senior government officials, by senior EU, NATO leaders, against precisely this kind of threat. And this is why the suggestion that falling back on other navigation systems using paper maps is some kind of major drama seems a little bit wide of the mark, because that is exactly what they'll be prepared for.
Okay, put your Russia expert cap back on. Another piece of background that may be useful to consider here. We don't know, as you note, whether or not von der Leyen was deliberately targeted. We do know that she has been a very public and outspoken critic of Vladimir Putin. And we do know that this trip was part of wider travels in Eastern Europe, stops in Finland, in the Baltics, in Poland, in Romania, stops that if you're Vladimir Putin, you might see as provocative.
Well, Vladimir Putin sees anything as provocative if it is intended to bolster the defense of Europe against Russia, but there's no particular reason to think that Russia would target von der Leyen specifically in Bulgaria as opposed to any of those countries, or indeed on any of the other long trips through multiple countries that she's undertaken as part of her mission. I think it's possibly a bit of a red herring to suggest that this was specific to this place and time, as opposed to Russia potentially just seeing an opportunity, or still, let's not rule out the possibility that this is just collateral damage from Russia's ongoing campaigns. Again, until we know the technical details, we simply have no way of assessing that.
Indeed. Well, I will start to bring us toward a close by mentioning that NATO, which obviously is focused on and created to guarantee European security, is taking the jamming seriously. I want to play a brief remark. This is NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte speaking today.
And I can assure you that we are working day and night to counter this, to prevent it, and to make sure that they will not do it again.
Keir Giles, what might that mean? What do you understand NATO would be able to do to say that they, the Russians, will not do it again?
It's extremely difficult to say what that might actually mean, especially when this has been going on for so very long. I'm sure that people in the far north of Norway, for example, where emergency services can't use GPS and can barely communicate as a result of Russian electronic warfare, would like something to have been done a long time ago. So yes, it'll be interesting to see just what exactly NATO has in mind when it thinks it's going to be able to stop Russia from doing this now, when it hasn't been over the previous decade.
Keir Giles of the London-based think tank Chatham House, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Coming up September 6th, we are so excited for Grand Rapids River Fest. Opening up will be Alan Sparhawk, who recently talked with Kari Hedlund about his new album with Trampled by Turtles.
I remember the time going like, man, I can't tell if this is any good. I'm questioning myself a lot here, but I don't know. There was a little bit of obligation, I think, because those guys had made room for me, put their trust in me, so to speak. I kind of had to tell myself, you know, I just need to push through and just sing, do the best I can, and trust that I'm in the hands of good people. I feel like I did. I found my voice. Thank you for thinking of me, and I'm glad to be there. Mim and I grew up out past Bemidji, so I'm looking forward to it.
Grand Rapids River Fest with Alan Sparhawk opening up, then Jeremy Albino, Margot Price, and Courtney Barnett. Get your tickets at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
Turn up the problem. It is 519. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local news stories and conversations at our website, kaxe.org. We do have a chance of rain and thunderstorms tonight with mostly cloudy skies, lows in the mid-40s to low 50s, winds from the northwest 10 to 20. Tomorrow, 30% chance of rain and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, highs in the 50s, breezy northwest winds. Lows tomorrow night, 35 to 40, and for Thursday, chance of showers in the afternoon, partly sunny, highs 55 to 60. There is more ahead from All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the University of Maryland Libraries, committed to reimagining learning, advancing the public good, and empowering research that creates a better future for everyone. More at lib.umd.edu. And from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Jane Kennedy will tell you she never had a goal to be famous. She didn't set out to become friends with athletes like Muhammad Ali or inspire other broadcasters like Oprah Winfrey. She describes in a new memoir, Plain Jane, that she just wanted to be the same Ohio kid and sports lover her parents raised. But her mom's suggestion that she enter a pageant put her on an unexpected path.
Well, Miss Ohio, I want to wish you luck.
Thank you.
You're among the 15 semifinalists already.
Thank you.
Yes.
Kennedy made it to the Miss USA semifinals in 1970 after becoming the first black woman to win Miss Ohio. A slew of on-screen roles and Hollywood connections came after. By 1978, when CBS Sports was looking to replace its sole female anchor on the NFL Today, she went for it. But she still had barriers to break once she got an audition.
I knew immediately they were not looking for someone like me because there were 16 women, 15 were blonde. And so, you know, I kicked back and I said, I'm just going to have a good time.
Kennedy focused on making friends during a mock interview with an athlete. Original NFL Today host Brent Musburger took notice.
We're laughing and talking, have a great time. And Brent Musburger stood up and said, it's Jane or nobody. But they still didn't want to hire me because they were afraid the Southern affiliates would have an issue with that.
So she only got a six-week trial on the job to start. I asked Jane Kennedy how she navigated that, as well as other major life events.
My second week, I overheard them looking for who was going to get the interview for Muhammad Ali post-fight.
And that's where you come in, right? Because you had
and
a relationship with him.
I put my hand in the air. I said, I can get you the interview. And they said, who are you? So I called Ali, told him what I was doing. He left a key for me at the front desk. We got the interview. And it opens with Muhammad Ali saying, I'd only do this for my friend Jane. Then I go home. Next morning, I wake up, phone call, Jane, your contract has been extended.
Jane, I have to ask you, what was the culture like on the show once that contract was extended, once you're in the mix?
On the show, it was great. It was off the show where it had the problems. Mm. A lot of reporters, male reporters, didn't want to have a woman in that desk at all. They certainly didn't want a black woman in that desk at all. But I didn't pay attention to that. I just said, I'm going to do the best that I possibly can. I knew a lot of the NFL players, and my old friend had told me, make a friend with whoever you interview. It doesn't matter what they do, you make a friend with them. And we're going out on the road doing all these interviews, and I'm having people, they're saying, no, we don't want to do an interview. And then they say, Jane Kennedy's doing the interview. And they say, oh, yes, we'll be there. We'll be there. But it was great to see the support that I got from the players around the league.
Jane Kennedy, I know ultimately you were let go from that job in 1980, and I don't want to spoil for readers all of the sort of CBS palace intrigue that you mentioned on what happened in that whole situation, but something I do want to ask you about is the pressure that you said you felt from others who felt that you should have perhaps fought harder to keep the job because of what you meant for Black representation in the business. Did that pressure feel fair at all?
You know, quite honestly, I was making sure that I was able to compete with anyone on the desk. And so it really hurt me when I was fired that there was a newspaper, the Chicago Defender, and they said, Jane should have kept her job. She let us down. She should have kept her job, even if she had to, excuse my language, even if she had to kiss butt, you know, the other word.
Right.
And that really hurt me. Because I had done everything right. I was supporting not only my people, but, you know, I wanted to make America know that a woman could do this job.
Yeah.
And that was important to me.
Jane, you also mentioned how the end of your NFL Today career was when you started to really take stock of your marriage to fellow actor Leon Kennedy. I know that difficult period in your relationship, it coincides with when, after you and Leon had been divorced for about 8 years, which you describe in the book as a privately recorded VHS tape of the two of you engaging in consensual married intimacy, or a sex tape, was stolen from his home and released. This is the first time that you've addressed that after 35 years. Why talk about it now?
Thank you for addressing it, firstly, as not a sex tape, because it wasn't. It was an intimate moment between two married, consenting people. And I was the one that decided not to have a press conference and talk about what had happened, because it was, I just couldn't live with it. It hurt too much. Mm-hmm. And it was a family member who stole the tape and released it. And it ruined both of us. Ruined my career drastically. I went through a deep depression. I didn't want to see anyone, talk to anyone except for family.
Having read the way that you've written about it and now listening to you speak about it, it sounds like it had a profound and just such a painful effect on you and really changed some of the trajectory of your life.
It did, because, you know, like people wanted to believe the negative. And I ended up believing it myself, I guess. Oh, gosh. Okay. Anyway.
It's okay. If you want to take a second, we can.
I eventually found a minister. I just saw him at his church on the street, and there was a glowing light out of the room, and they were having choir practice. A small little church. And I waited until everyone left, and I told the pastor, I said, I need to speak with you. And I explained to him what happened. And I said, I need to learn how to forgive. And he says, who are you forgiving? And I said, I don't know. And 6 months later, I realized that I needed to forgive myself. And I said goodbye to him and said, I'll see you next week for a regular session. And I came back the next week and the church was gone and never saw him again. So my life has moments like that. I almost died in Hawaii and this person saved me and I walked back to shore and turned around to look out at the ocean, turned around, he was gone. And my mom told me that I had a purpose, and I hadn't met my purpose yet. And he was my angel. So I was waiting again for Plain Jane to show me my purpose. Mm. That was my search through the entire process of writing Plain Jane. I was looking for my purpose, and I found it.
We've been speaking with Jane Kennedy about her memoir, Plain Jane. Jane, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed myself.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 529. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from The Sewing Room, hosting the Cultivating Community Summit, September 22nd and 23rd in Brainerd. This two-day event features keynotes, interactive workshops, live music, and a special film screening. Full details can be found at sewingroom.org. Chance of showers tonight with lows in the mid-40s to low-50s.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. A Bagley teenager has died in a car crash over Labor Day weekend. The Clearwater County Sheriff's Office says a report came in just before 8 a.m. Monday of a crash on Southwest Tower Avenue in Bagley. A deputy found a vehicle on its roof about a quarter mile south of Highway 2. The Sheriff's Office says the driver appeared to have lost control as he entered the curve and went off the road and rolled. 18-year-old James Johnson was the sole occupant and was ejected from the vehicle. An ambulance brought Johnson to the Bagley Medical Center, where he was pronounced dead. The Leech Lake Housing Authority offices in Cass Lake were destroyed in a fire early Monday. The Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe says the building is a total loss. The band says the cause of the fire is under investigation. Housing staff are working to establish temporary operations so services can continue for band members. The band says it will share updates as soon as they are available. Governor Tim Walz will call a special session for lawmakers to vote on a package of gun control measures. The Minnesota Reformer reports Walz made the announcement Tuesday outside Deerwood Elementary School in Eagan. The governor says Minnesota needs to take action after last week's mass shooting at Annunciation Church in Minneapolis that killed two children and wounded 21 others. He says he will release a gun control package this week that includes an assault weapons ban. Republicans have a one-seat majority in the House after the June assassination of DFL Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman. The Reformer reports Walz plans to call a special session even if he gets zero commitments from Republicans to vote for the gun control legislation. He and other DFL lawmakers hope the recent shooting would pressure Republicans to vote on gun control. North Memorial takes over the Nashwauk ambulance on Wednesday. Manager Rob Almendinger says residents can continue to expect timely and reliable service with the change. The Nashwauk ambulance service area covers much of eastern Itasca County, stretching north to Bearville Township and south to Goodland. It also includes parts of Taconite and Balsam Township and Marble, Calumet, and Keewatin. The city of Nashwauk has owned and operated the ambulance service since the early 2000s. After years of struggling financially, the county board voted to take it over and created a special taxing district in February to pay for the emergency medical services. The Nashwauk service will be under the same supervisor as North Memorial's Grand Rapids office. The Twin Cities-based nonprofit bought Meds One ambulance service in Grand Rapids in 2024. Nashwauk area residents can expect to see many of the same faces. Almendinger says they hired all staff who wanted to continue with North Memorial, but they will see a new rig.
They will have, if not brand new, fairly close to brand new type 2 van ambulances, which are smaller, all-wheel drive, easier to maneuver and operate.
Almendinger says Nashwauk's two current ambulances will be stationed elsewhere. The overnight warming shelter for those experiencing homelessness in the Brainerd Lakes area has reopened. Chelsea Perkins has more.
The Bridge on 7th shelter is operated by the nonprofit Bridges of Hope. It opened its doors in South Brainerd for the fifth season on Monday. The shelter operates nightly from 7 p.m. to 8 a.m. from September through May. The Bridge offers guests who are 18 or older a place to sleep, personal necessities provided by donors, and support from trained staff. It's one of the few low-barrier overnight shelters available in northern Minnesota. Earlier this year, the organization sought a change to the permit to keep it open year-round. The request came after the city councils in Brainerd and Baxter instituted camping bans on public property in 2024. But the Brainerd City Council denied the request to stay open, citing concerns that the resource attracted people from outside the community or created public safety issues. Dozens spoke out against this decision, while shelter leaders noted this left some of the most vulnerable without a legal place to sleep. The shelter must also now return annually to request to renew its permit instead of every 3 years as a result of council action. People may visit the Bridges of Hope website to learn more about how to donate or volunteer. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation, streaming at BritBox.com. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The food giant Kraft Heinz is breaking up. Heinz ketchup going one way, Oscar Mayer hot dogs the other.
Oh, I'd love to be an Oscar Mayer wiener. That is what I truly like to be.
The breakup of Kraft Heinz is undoing a mega merger staged by Warren Buffett. It's considered one of his notable missteps. NPR's Alina Selyuk is here to walk us through this. Hey, Alina.
Hello, hello.
Why is Kraft Heinz breaking up?
Well, just think about the size of the company, for starters. It is one of the biggest food conglomerates in the world. One official said it has 56 different product categories, from ketchup to hot dogs, but also Cool Whip and Jell-O and Capri Sun. Executives acknowledge that the company is spreading its focus too thin. The CEO, Carlos Abrams Rivera, told analysts on a call this morning that these are popular brands and there is a runway to keep growing globally.
But the complexity of our business has impacted that ability to realize the full strength of our brands and operations.
So they are splitting apart. One company will have the faster growing sauces and spreads business, including Heinz condiments, Philadelphia cream cheese, and also the mac and cheese part of Kraft. And then the other company will be the slower growing grocery business with Lunchables, Oscar Mayer, Maxwell House, and Kraft Singles.
The CEO just said there that the business is too complex now. How'd that happen?
It was a mega merger 10 years ago, orchestrated by Warren Buffett and this private equity firm called 3G Capital. Buffett really loves these brands, these lasting household American brands. You know, Heinz has been making condiments for over a century. Kraft Brothers were selling cheese by horse and wagon before the Great Depression.
Wow.
And so 10 years ago, Buffett partnered with 3G to combine the two. And 3G was famous for successful mergers and intense cost cutting. But their strategy just did not work so well at Kraft Heinz.
Why not? What was different?
Packaged and processed foods have seen some difficult times over the past decade here in the U.S. People's tastes have changed. Younger shoppers are asking for options with extra protein or extra fiber. And if people are going for brand name processed foods, they often reach for something that claims to be higher quality. And then high inflation pushed shoppers to reconsider their loyalty to big brands. And actually, this seemed unimaginable a decade ago. And now I regularly talk to shoppers who are switching to store brand chips or store brand mayonnaise after, you know, religiously buying the same brand since childhood. And Kraft Heinz has spent much of this transformative time cutting costs and has really struggled to meet this moment.
Has Warren Buffett said anything about this? What does he think about the breakup?
Historically, he's really blamed the rise of store brands and has said, you know, unwavering in his faith in Kraft and Heinz brands. And today, Berkshire Hathaway has not responded to NPR. But Buffett did send notes to CNBC saying he was disappointed and that, quote, it certainly didn't turn out to be a brilliant idea to put them together, but I don't think that taking them apart will fix it. Kraft Heinz, of course, says it is happening, and the deal is expected to complete later this year.
NPR's Alina Selyuk, thank you.
Thank you. People who inherit two copies of a common gene variant are very likely to develop Alzheimer's disease. NPR's John Hamilton talked to three scientists who got tested and who are grappling with the results.
The gene variant is called APOE4. Inheriting a single copy can triple your risk for Alzheimer's. Inheriting two copies, one from each parent, means you'll probably have symptoms before age 85. This very high-risk status applies to fewer than 3% of people in the U.S. One of them is June, a Ph.D. biochemist who found out from an online genetic testing service.
I was so distressed, and I've never felt so scared in my life.
June asked to use only her first name. She fears making her genetic status public could affect her job or health insurance. At first, June spent hours online reading academic papers about Alzheimer's and genetics. Then she discovered online communities made up of people like her.
I not only found useful information, I forged deep friendships.
June learned about the brain benefits of a Mediterranean diet, exercise, sleep, and stress reduction. And her online communities led her to a research project at the University of California, San Diego. June enrolled in a four-month study there that had her playing a strenuous virtual reality game.
You're riding a bike and you go through unfamiliar terrain where you need to make turns. So you really have to use all your cognitive reserve.
June says the study also involved a series of MRI scans and cognitive tests.
I not only was able to watch my brain in action, I was able to develop really effective strategies of learning and retaining my memory.
Lots of mental and physical activity might delay the symptoms of Alzheimer's, but David Watson, a neuropsychologist who runs the Alzheimer's Research and Treatment Center in Florida, says that's not enough for people with the APOE4 variant.
Any of these things that we can do preventively, they're going to be helpful, but are they going to override genetics? No, they're not, unfortunately.
Watson, who's in his mid-50s, learned that he carries two copies of the APOE4 gene about 25 years ago. He began running clinical trials of Alzheimer's drugs in hopes of finding one that might protect his brain. That work helped get two drugs on the market. Unfortunately, Watson is not a good candidate for either of them. The drugs are both monoclonal antibodies that remove sticky amyloid plaques from the brain. Watson says in people with his genetic profile, that often causes the brain to swell or bleed.
If someone is APOE4/4, they probably should not go on a monoclonal antibody targeting amyloid, or certainly, you know, very cautiously with additional counseling.
So Watson has been focusing on an experimental drug that's meant specifically for people who are APOE4/4 or homozygous. He says the pill, which was tested at his center, is designed to interrupt the process that leads to amyloid plaques.
And this particular compound, which was targeted and designed and researched only on homozygote 4/4 patients, actually showed remarkable findings.
The drug, made by Alcyon, did not cause brain swelling or bleeding, and it kept brain areas associated with memory from shrinking the way they usually do in Alzheimer's. But the drug did not clearly show it could slow down cognitive decline in people who already had Alzheimer's symptoms. Even so, researchers think it might still help a person without symptoms, someone like Wendy Nelson.
I would absolutely take the Alcyon pill tomorrow if I could get access.
Nelson is a Ph.D. scientist in the biotech industry who carries two copies of the APOE4 variant.
I'm a triathlete. I just did a PEMI loop in the White Mountains this weekend. I eat healthy.
Nelson is 54 and has three daughters who carry a single copy of the APOE4 gene. So she jumped at the chance to meet with FDA officials who oversee Alzheimer's drugs.
A couple weeks ago, I provided my 7 minutes of testimony to the FDA, which was my plea for more options because I don't feel like I have anything out there right now.
June, the biochemist, also testified. She says the experience was empowering.
I realized that being APOE4/4 homozygous is not the end of the world. There are so many things we can do.
Like making lifestyle changes, finding community, and pushing the government to keep funding Alzheimer's research. John Hamilton, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. There are just a few weeks left for federal discounts on electric vehicles. Tax credits worth up to $7,500 expire at the end of September under President Trump's tax and spending bill. The deadline has led to a spike in EV sales and whiplash for auto dealers. Sam Brash of Colorado Public Radio reports.
Scott Nelson has wanted an EV for years, but the Denver resident only started taking test drives after realizing the federal tax credit wasn't going to stick around for much longer.
Over the last probably 3 weeks, I've been really doing the research. So, it's really been kind of fast-tracked.
Nelson is behind the wheel of a Volkswagen ID.4, an all-electric SUV. Matt Foster sits in the passenger seat. He sells cars at Emmick Volkswagen in Denver.
We are the number one ID.4 dealership in the country. So yes, we've seen a big increase.
It's a pattern playing out nationwide. Drivers are rushing to grab EVs before the $7,500 federal tax credit expires. It's extra easy to apply the incentive to leases. The credit was authorized under former President Biden to boost climate-friendly technologies. President Trump worked with Congress to scrap it. In Colorado, buyers get an even better deal. The state has its own EV tax credits, and dealers like Foster bundle everything together into eye-popping leases for cars like the ID.4.
Our ad special is at $39 with $2,000 due at signing.
$39 a month.
That is correct.
The total is more like $100 per month after taxes. That's still a fraction of the average lease payment in the U.S. Those low prices kickstarted an EV boom in Colorado. Last fall, the state briefly eclipsed California in EV market share. But that's about to change. The federal tax credit is going away, and the state credit is shrinking. That's left local car dealers nervous about the future.
Anything that makes cars more expensive is bad for dealers, right?
Matt Groves leads the Colorado Auto Dealers Association. Dealers make money on volume by selling as many cars as possible. And Groves says the subsidies brought more customers into showrooms.
Now, we were hoping that these tax credits were going to stick around long enough that we could find price parity between EVs and internal combustion vehicles. That didn't happen.
Which means Colorado dealers will likely market fewer EVs once the credits are gone. Analysts expect EV sales nationwide will be significantly lower over the next decade because of the rollbacks. But in Colorado, some dealers wish the government wasn't stepping back.
It's been such a good ride, I guess, over the last year and a half or so.
Ed Olson is the sales manager at Boulder Nissan. His dealership pioneered the concept of rock-bottom EV leases in Colorado. Last summer, for example, it offered an all-electric Nissan Leaf for $9 per month before taxes and fees.
Our volume was so big, it made a lot of sense for us because we all of a sudden were selling five times as many cars as we were, you know, the month before.
It's a strategy Olson can use for a few more weeks. Ahead of the deadline, his lot is packed bumper to bumper with all-electric Nissan Arias.
My goal here was to just try to stock what we're going to sell.
Wow. And how long do you think it'll take to clear this many cars?
I need to hopefully have them all done by September 30th. I'd like to not have any of them come October.
After that, he says his dealership will return to its old business model, selling gas cars and used vehicles. For NPR News, I'm Sam Brash in Boulder, Colorado.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Thank you for listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It's 5:48. Coming up at 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also hear our album of the week. Coming up at 7 o'clock, On the River. It's a great mix of music. Your volunteer host this evening is Dave Murphy. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde, available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Our question of the week, we are getting ready for Grand Rapids River Fest this Saturday. Have you been? You can tell us about your experiences or other live concerts you went to because you heard about the artists on KAXE. Text in 218-326-1234. Weather for this evening, chance of rain and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, lows in the mid-40s to low 50s, winds from the northwest 10 to 20. 30% chance of rain and thunderstorms tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs 50 to 59. Breezy northwest winds, and our lows tomorrow night 35 to 40. For Thursday, chance of showers in the afternoon, partly sunny, highs 55 to 60. Support comes from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwood since 1930. Patterson's features clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smartwool. Pattersonsclothing.com. McCroskey Art Center in Grand Rapids hosts an opening reception for the group exhibit Expressing Grief this Friday, September 5th from 4 to 7. Five regional artists come together to honor the experience of grief in its many forms. And you can find a full list of First Friday Art Walk stops at grandrapidsarts.org. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library welcome author Carrie J. Griffiths on Monday, September 8th at noon. He'll discuss his book, Rattlesnake Bluff, A Sam Rivers Mystery. You may bring your own lunch or enjoy the light refreshments provided.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. 20 years ago, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, there was an exodus from New Orleans. At least 100,000 people who left found refuge in Houston. Many of them stayed there and helped reshape the largest city in Texas. Houston Public Media's Dominic Anthony Walsh reports.
When Jermaine Moore needs a haircut, he looks for barbers from New Orleans. At a Shaving Grace barbershop in the southeast Houston area, he's found one.
New Orleans barbers cut different. Our hair texture is different. This is not processed, this is my mother, but everybody can't cut it.
Moore is retired now. Before 2005, he lived a comfortable life as an IT professional in New Orleans. That changed after Katrina destroyed his home. While staying with family in Houston, he turned on the TV and saw his house in the floodwaters.
Yeah, some of them house in the news. Watched everything float away and looking down at that overnight bag, realizing that and my truck outside, that's all I got left. Yeah.
He says he realized he would have to stay in Houston after he went back to New Orleans to survey the damage.
You know, I just like to stand in an American city and hear not a bird chirp, not a cricket. You hear nothing. It is the smell of absolute death. I've never smelled anything like that in my life. And you start to wonder, can I live here?
Back then, many residents of New Orleans were asking the same question. Exactly how many people came to Houston is hard to say, with researchers and former city officials putting the number anywhere from 100,000 to 300,000. Tens of thousands are estimated to remain. 20 years later, they've changed Houston, and Houston has changed them. Jermaine Moore met his wife in Houston. He also found a barber from New Orleans.
You don't want no ball, you want life aid, mid life aid, I got you.
Can you get me here?
Thank you.
For sure.
John Speedy Riddle started cutting hair about a decade after he arrived in Houston at the age of 15. His family home also flooded during Katrina. Aside from short visits, his family never returned. Still, he finds meaning in the loss.
I would have never got to live the life I've experienced up to 35 years old if it wouldn't have been for Katrina.
He was among as many as 6,000 students from New Orleans who came to the Houston Independent School District, with thousands more attending schools outside the city after Katrina interrupted the beginning of their school year. The memories of the evacuation still bring tears to Riddle's eyes. But Moore says there's more to the story than pain.
Katrina hurt, but you're supposed to find a blessing in a curse.
I finished high school out here. I don't think I would have, at 15, the life I was living in New Orleans, the things I got away with that my parents don't know, I wouldn't have made it.
No.
I wouldn't have lasted this long.
Right. See, Houston, for him, at 15, turn around. Showed him a completely different path.
It showed me childhood.
Yeah, he lost his community in New Orleans. The curse, the blessing, look at him.
I found a tribe here.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Blessing and a curse.
Sociologist Jim Elliott with Rice University also left after Katrina and eventually settled in Houston. He says the cultural impact of the evacuees is undeniable.
We have to keep in mind that this was the largest evacuation in terms of numbers and completeness in U.S. history.
Exactly how large? It's hard to know. And it's difficult to say how many stayed long term. Either way, those who remained changed the culture. Greenings-y Houston, New Orleans-style jazz, events like the White Linen Night block parties, and Cajun twists on existing dishes like gumbo and crawfish boils.
What the New Orleanians did, I suspect, is they entered into this sort of gumbo, if you will, and began to add a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
20 years later, tens of thousands of New Orleanians, including Jermaine Moore and John Riddle, see Houston as a place of new beginnings, opportunity, and community. They also see more of New Orleans in Houston.
The good part that has changed, our influence. I can find daiquiris now.
Yeah.
I can find food like home now.
I can go to H-E-B and buy blue plate mayonnaise and Patton's hot sauces from Fiesta.
I know that sounds stupid, but y'all don't understand how important that is to us. I can find more remnants of home, actual home. 20 years ago, we were fish out of water.
They say with the curse of losing home, there's also the blessing of finding and changing Houston. For NPR News, I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in Houston.
American Vogue has a new editorial chief. Chloe Mal is the current editor of Vogue's website and co-host of the podcast The Run-Through with Vogue. As NPR culture correspondent Anastasia Tsiolkas reports, Mal has big designer heels to step into.
Chloe Mal succeeds Anna Wintour, the famous and famously steely presence who commanded the fashion world for 37 years and who was immortalized in the film The Devil Wears Prada. This is a promotion for Chloe Mal, who's 39 years old. Mal comes from Hollywood royalty. Her father was the French film director Louis Mal, and her mother is actress Candice Bergen. This morning, Mal told the New York Times she would prefer to drop the traditional monthly publishing schedule for the magazine and instead print occasional, more collectible issues. Last year, print circulation of Vogue dwindled to fewer than a million copies per issue on average. Jessica Testa interviewed Mal for the New York Times today.
I think their hope is that when you go and buy your new issue of Vogue, you're going to pose with it on your Instagram feed or your TikTok or whatever, that it's going to be a sort of status symbol that you're going to be like carrying it around with you.
Almost as its own high fashion accessory, Mel also said she wants to lean into reaching a smaller and more elite audience for both print and digital. This summer, she wrote a digital cover story on the wedding of Lauren Sanchez and billionaire Jeff Bezos. Testa says it might signal her editorial direction.
It actually reminded me of early Vogue, which was focused on society women. You know, it didn't feel as familiar as modern era Vogue with different celebrities on the cover.
And what about Anna Wintour, the former editor-in-chief of Vogue? She's staying on as the chief content officer at Condé Nast, Vogue's parent company. And she'll oversee all 28 international editions of Vogue, just down the hall from Mal. And she'll still be Mal's boss. Anastasia Tsiolkas, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG. Our purpose is people. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options.
at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It is a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9, and you can find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks so much.